Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. We have a listener question special for you today. We'll have another of them next week, and then we'll look back on the events that have taken place since Wimbledon in the shows in the weeks thereafter. Before we get on to your questions, I wanted to mention news that we received today, very sad news about the death of Peter McNamara at the age of 64. Catherine and I will pay tribute to him properly next week because we both got to know him well over the years. But just in short, I wanted to touch on the fact that Peter was best known for his doubles partnership with compatriot Paul McNamee. They won two Wimbledon titles together in 1980 and 1982, an Australian Open title in 1979, and Peter also reached number 7 in the world as a singles player. He coached Grigor Dimitrov and Mark Philippoussis, and most recently Wang Qiang, to great success. You may remember she got to number 20 in the world late last year, and they were together for 4 years in a fantastic coach-player relationship which ended in February of this year. Peter died on Saturday from prostate cancer. None of us knew about it. It's something he kept to himself, but it's terribly sad news, and our thoughts are with Peter's wife Petra, his friends and family, and as I said, we'll talk more about Peter in the show next week.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
One, two, three.
It's like when they give the results on Eurovision. This is London calling.
Hello.
We give 8 points to Macedonia.
This is Catherine Whittaker, everybody, who is talking because I just did an intro in which I said, this is David Law calling, when I meant to say, hello, everybody, Tennis Podcast listeners, this is David Law speaking. And I'm currently on holiday at the moment, so we're not doing normal tennis podcasts. We're doing an extra one from the grounds at Wimbledon. And we're doing a listener's questions special, guest edited by our mascot owner. Who's our guest mascot owner?
Alex Petalas.
Oh, thank goodness you're here, because I couldn't have said that, Alex. No offence whatsoever, but I'm not as good at Matt with all the old pronunciations. Who is the owner of Rio with a Y, our special mascot for 2019, and has backed us in our Kickstarter at the end of last year in order so that we could help keep going and create as many tennis podcasts as we possibly could, and we'll be doing the same at the end of this year, and there will be a mascot slot up for grabs, etc., etc. But so thank you, Alex, for doing that. It's been a great support you've given us, and now it's your turn to ask us, Catherine, Matt and myself, the best of your questions. You've chosen a few of your own. You've also selected the best of those that have been sent in to us by our listeners. So, without further ado, Matt, get cracking.
The first one regarding Garbine Muguruza, and Alex asks, who do you think would be a good coach for Muguruza now that she's finally split with Sam Sumyk? And if not a person, what do you think she needs to get back on track?
It's a good question, Alex. It's a really good question.
I think she needs to put in a big money offer to Conchita Martinez to prize her away from Karolina Pliskova.
She won Wimbledon with Conchita Martinez. Sam Sumyk was at home in the States, but I think his wife was given whatever, he wasn't here. And that was her last Grand Slam. Came a little bit out of nowhere. She hadn't had the consistency coming in, but certainly more consistency than she's had in the two intervening years. that is the only formula that we know works for Garbini Muguruza.
I mean, that
so far
slightly does Samsonic a disservice, doesn't it? Because she did win the French Open with him by her side. It's not like
it's very early days.
Yeah, but it hasn't been a wholly unsuccessful partnership. It's just the last 2 years have been
toxic.
Not only. Well, and that's a good word, I would say. I mean, certainly from the outside, it has felt like that. We don't have insider knowledge, I don't think, to be able to judge in any great detail. But it hasn't looked a comfortable alliance. Whenever he has come onto the court, the body language between the two has not been something particularly great to look at. And moreover, the results have been appalling for a player of her standard. I mean, this is a player who reached the Wimbledon final a few years ago, then backed it up by winning the French Open, beating Serena Williams in the final, then reaches the Wimbledon final and wins that. So you're talking about a player who's got two Grand Slam titles. She then got to world number one. And I thought she was the most likely player to take over from Serena Williams and have a period of relative domination. Maybe even a little like Novak Djokovic in the men's game. I thought that this sort of thing would be possible, certainly pre-2015 Djokovic. I thought she would have a run of tournaments where she would maybe win half a dozen slams in 3 years or something like that. And she's sitting on two. She's outside the top 20. She's just there for the taking way too often at Grand Slams. I don't get it. So something needed to change, and I'm pleased that she has taken that step.
Yeah, I'm too. It's felt so inevitable for so long, and for that reason it's felt like she's been treading water at best. And it's such a shame, because I mean, I was going to say we all know her potential. It's not potential. We've seen it come to fruition twice at Grand Slam tournaments, two very different Grand Slam tournaments. At that time it felt like there is nowhere and no how, not a word, that she can't win, and since then it's felt like wow, she can find ways to lose that we never thought possible. Certainly not on a regular basis. I found it really bizarre what's happened to her over the last couple of years, and I'm pleased that this split has come. Not as you say, I'm sure there were positive elements to it, and I'm sure there was a time when it felt like it was working. But without question, it's been a long time coming, the split, and I wait eagerly to see who she'll go with. I mean, who's on the market?
Well, if you could...
Cahill?
He's the sort of coach that I think could work with an awful lot of players. But again, I don't feel like I know Garbiñe Muguruza much. I've interviewed her once or twice. She's so different to what I expected her to be in terms of how her career has unfolded, because when she first reached the Wimbledon final here, I remember the first time I saw her was in Australia. She played really well there. Then she came here and she reached the final here, and in her pre-final press conference she was so open and so interesting and so full of the joy of it all. The joy has gone, and I hate that. I hate seeing a player who looks as though it's a bit of a chore.
And she has shut down with the media, hasn't she? Without question, she has that slightly Sharapova-esque glazed expression in press conferences, and to my knowledge she hasn't had a bad experience. I wonder if she's had that bad experience perhaps with the Spanish media. A guy called Antonio that works, he does a number of different things, all to great effect. He works for the Rafa Nadal Academy. He also does some work for Spanish Eurosport, and Antonio Arenas, and he has a really good relationship with Garbiñe Muguruza, probably as good as any individual I know, and he really struggles to get anything out of her. And he said that wasn't always the case. He says she does have this touchy relationship with the Spanish media. I think he puts a lot of it down to the tension about whether she would choose to compete for Spain or for Venezuela. You'd think the fact that she elected to compete for Spain would endear her to the Spanish public. You know, you're not just representing your country because you have to and you haven't got any other countries you could play for. You've actively chosen to compete for Spain, but something's gone wrong there somewhere along the line, and He once said to me that he had done an interview with her, trying to get a bit of levity out of her, asking her a few sort of slightly off-the-wall questions. And he said, if you weren't a tennis player, what would you be? And she immediately said, an actress. And he said he found that so insightful, that because that's what he feels like she's doing all the time. She's not herself. She's inhabiting a role. And
I'd love to get to know her, really.
Yeah.
And just see what sort of person she is, because she just feels like, it feels like there is a champion in there way beyond what we have right now. I don't know whether technically she has also maybe found a ceiling to her game to some degree, because I mean she's a tall woman with big hits, but I always think back to when Caroline Wozniacki had it put to her that she was in the group of ball strikers at the WTA finals, because she was in with Pliskova and she was in with Ostapenko, I think, and Muguruza, and she said, oh, Muguruza's not a big hitter, which I found really interesting. And I think the view was she's a relentless striker of a ball, but she doesn't have explosive power. I was surprised by that, but you know.
But there is an issue, and it's an extremely delicate issue, and one that we can't really go into without hearing in all frankness, which I don't think we're going to get from her herself. But she has lost a lot of weight, and she's lost a lot of weight on her ball, hasn't she, over the last couple of years? And that is without doubt a factor. She doesn't hit as big a ball as she used to. I don't know if that's a conscious decision. I don't know what's going on, because we don't hear from her, and we can't put words in her mouth. So
no,
it's very difficult for us to go into. Daniela Hantikova talked about it at the US Open last year, and that was at the time that Elena Svitolina had lost a lot of weight as well, and it felt like a bit of a pattern, I'm reluctant to say trend, but certainly something that was more than just an isolated case. And she's in a far better position to talk about it than I or we are. But on the bare facts of it, that is a factor, isn't it? She has lost some weight of shot over the last couple of years, I think.
Yeah, but I kind of feel the biggest point is she just doesn't look very happy out there, and I want to see the joy return. And I wonder, let's just have a quick think about a few coaches around. I mean, okay, not necessarily, I know I've said Caroline Pliskova's coach, Conchita Martinez, but what about people that are not currently tied up? And do we think that she would benefit from maybe having a female coach as opposed to a male coach, for a point of difference there? And also, I don't know, maybe just somebody...
I think a lot could. There are some great male coaches out there. I mean, in fact, I think at the moment there are some really, really great examples of really healthy female male coaching relationships. You know,
I was going to say
Kiki Bertens and Raymond Slaughter.
Wouldn't it be great if Muguruza could find her own Raymond Slaughter type, who she just
Do you think a woman perhaps might be best for her? And this, I mean, it's wild speculation, because exactly as you've said, we don't know her, do we?
No.
We don't know her at all, sort of. But I do think someone that could get to the root of her emotionally.
Mm. She's young enough, isn't she?
She's
plenty
enough.
Of time. Have you got any thoughts, Matt?
I think whenever I've been in a press conference recently with Muguruza, it is almost as though she still sees herself as the player she was 2 years ago. It's almost as though she needs that acceptance that she's no longer able... I mean, she shouldn't be carrying herself with such a regal...
It's a sort of strength and a curse, isn't it? Because when she does carry herself like that, you do go, wow, she's the bomb, you know, in the way she carries herself around.
Is she any different in Spanish, with the Spanish media, to what she is in English?
I've not seen enough to say, but the one I saw at Wimbledon was incredibly similar in English and Spanish. She just shut the questions down as though she wasn't willing to engage. But
just wanted to get through it.
But then obviously she did make the coaching change. So that in itself is surely the first step of the acceptance. So I think that's a good sign. Also, about her game, you know, in the last 2 years, we have seen this variety come into women's tennis, and that isn't necessarily what Muguruza's strengths are. So potentially it's possible that the game has caught up with her a little bit and she needs to add layers to her actual game.
Well, she doesn't like it if somebody does mess her around because she wants to play that metronomic style. I mean, her against Konta at the Australian Open this year was just such a great match, but it was two women standing toe to toe and saying bring it on, and they were going back and forth. They were extraordinary rallies, but nobody really was throwing in variety, and you can see players are able to get under her skin probably in a similar way to how they can get to Konta. What I would say is that about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I noticed Muguruza was going to the net a lot. You know, every time she hit a decent ground stroke, she was in there. And I did like that tactic for her, being a tall woman with a wingspan.
Was that when she was with Martinez?
I think it was with both. I think that they had decided for her to go in, but I've not noticed that as much recently. But then I just feel like there's just not been as much get up and go about Muguruza. No. She's felt as though she's not really with us at times in matches, and I think that's really sad. So I hope she finds her way, because she's tennis got could, such a lot to offer.
Tennis could benefit from her doing that. I mean, we're sat here a couple of hours after Simona Halep's won the Wimbledon title, and we've been discussing whether or not she could go on to dominate. And I was discussing earlier with Conchita Martinez about, you know, what this means for Pliskova, who she's still working with, and the fact that, you know, Pliskova should be watching what Halep did today and thinking, that should be me doing that, you know. And I want Muguruza to be watching it in the same way, thinking the same things, but she doesn't feel even in the Pliskova bracket.
Well done,
remotely.
By the way, with the Conchita Martinez pronunciation, which I've been completely messing
been
up.
I've been working on it.
I've messed that up all through this podcast and several others.
The thing is, I always used to say Martinez, and then something got in my... I got the yips.
You got the David Laws.
Influence.
You hung out with me too much on this show.
I think an interesting sort of tangent to questions like this is, it's very difficult for us to recommend a coach for someone because there's so much more to
you
coaching
relationships.
It's like recommending a boyfriend for somebody, isn't it? Or
so
a girlfriend.
There's so much
it's
more
chemistry.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's.
I'd quite like to have a go at it. So, you know, see if I can come up
all
with
right.
a great name.
Go for it.
Come on, Garbine, yeah?
What?
Get me on the team as your consultant.
Oh, I thought you were saying you'd like to recommend boyfriends and girlfriends for people.
I wouldn't mind being a coach. I reckon I could be good. What do you think? What do you think? If I was her coach,
what
right,
would you tell her?
Do you think she would do all right? She's already a world-class player who's won two slams.
Well, there are examples of coaches that haven't been
any good.
I mean, Roger Rashid is the one that springs to mind. He was an Aussie Rules player,
good,
wasn't
though.
He
can play though.
He wasn't a...
Former player.
Wasn't a former player.
Yeah. So you think I could...
You obviously have to know how to hit tennis balls, but...
Why are you looking at me like that?
There's different types of coaches, aren't there?
Yeah. What did we think then?
You could be a sort of inspirational figure.
Why are you saying it like that?
I don't think Garbine Muguruza should be going after you as her next coach. Put it that way.
Okay.
Well, any of us, to
be fair. We'll end that there then. What do you think? At Tennis Podcast, could David Law be a decent coach for Garbine Muguruza if she was desperate?
I'm not sure the listeners are aware of your credentials.
Do I need some?
Are we? Is David?
I might be an untapped source, for all you know.
What would you tell her? What would you say to her?
Enjoy it.
Yeah, but you can't just tell... It's like telling someone to be happy. You can't... How? And she would say... How do I do that, David?
Just, it's not the end of the world, is it? Go and have a good time out there.
That's like when someone says, cheer up, love, it might never happen.
Hardly.
The worst thing you can possibly say to a person.
What stuff do I say to you that works? I don't.
It's okay, we'll deal with this later.
There you go. That's what I'd say.
Then you text Matt and say, don't reply to her. Don't reply to her, Matt.
Yeah, I think what we've learned is give things time before responding.
Okay, Garbine, I'm in the market. Actually, no, I'm not, because I've got a tennis podcast to present. So, sorry, you're out of luck. Right.
Shall we have the next question?
Next question. That one's taken 17 minutes.
It was a really good question.
So the next one is, if you could make unlimited changes to the tennis calendar, what would those be? I.e., adding certain tournaments in certain locations, removing some, or just changing it all around? How do you think the calendar needs to change?
Unlimited changes. It would almost be an easier question if it were, you can make two changes. Mm. What would they be? What would the priority changes be? I mean, I want to see one brilliantly successful team competition for men and women combined.
Yeah, I think that would be the first thing I would want ahead of everything. I agree with you. Yeah, just something that has the feel of everything that we've loved about Fed Cup and Davis Cup over the years, but which has common sense attached to it in a way that it can be marketed. And I mean, look, there are some very good parts to Laver Cup. I'd love to get the good bits of Laver Cup into that team event.
Yeah.
But one that has this feeling of just, you would put your life on the line almost to win it. It needs to be that level of importance. It needs to be something all the players... It's not even a conversation about whether they play. Same as the four Grand Slams. Of course we're playing. Hmm. It's the World Cup of team tennis. Of course we're playing. And at the moment, you have this... I have people still saying to me, I don't know why you're going on about the old Davis Cup. There was lots of players that played it. But... why are we having to justify this?
This is ridiculous.
So it's already not good enough. And then you have people who rightly laud the success of the Laver Cup, but try so hard to ram it down your throat that this has to be immediately accepted and it's the best thing since sliced bread right now. Well, look, there's lots going for it, but it's not the solution on its own. Come together and figure it out. Bang your heads together and work it out. But I accept that that's part of just so much of a wider problem of personal individual interests and already contracts that are ingrained in the sport, and how do you make things move in order to make it work?
I do like the idea, well, not idea, I mean the prospect of the Fed Cup being in April, the Fed Cup finals being in April. I think we're so wedded to the idea of the team competition finals being at the end of the year that it sort of felt inconceivable that they might not be. But when the ITF announced that the Fed Cup finals would be in April, I sort of thought, oh, yeah, that does feel like a bit of a gap in the calendar, and particularly if you hold them in Europe. And obviously there's no guarantee. It's a three-year deal with Budapest, I think, and that was one of the things they were quizzed about the launch press conference. Okay, does its position in the calendar in April mean that it will always have to be in Europe? And that is potentially an issue they'll have to face in the future, because you want it to be an international competition. But April makes quite good sense to me. And now the women's calendar is looking to be substantially shorter than the men's calendar, isn't it?
Of course, because you won't have Fed Cup at the end of the year. I mean, and it's already shorter, isn't it? Because the Shenzhen WTA finals is what, mid-October?
So it'll be a full 2 months off.
Yeah, which feels like enough. I mean, on one hand, calendar changes, people always jump to the season needs to be shorter, and I think sort of on one hand, yes. On the other hand, but a load of exhibition events would just crop up that all the players are playing. And on the third hand that I don't have, I don't want there to be less tennis.
If you could just rip it all up, though, and start all over again, would you move the slams about at all? I mean,
I'd put the tours together. If I was starting from scratch, the tours are unified. We don't talk about men's and women's tennis, we just talk about tennis.
You only have combined events.
And I think if I was completely starting from scratch, I would have... I mean, it's impossible because of, as you were saying, all the contracts and sponsorship and stuff that's already in the sport, but I would have fewer annual events. I mean, I think the slams would all be annual events, and you would have an annual team event, but maybe you could have sort of swings where one year everyone goes to Asia and it's like a great big thing and all the players go there. The next year you've got swings in Europe that everyone goes to. And I just think that you could market it differently, and there's potential there for there to be fewer events but more really big events.
The problem you would have is whether tournaments could make it work if they're only sort of occasional.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other one is that players have this is their job, you know, and they need a lot of events in order to make it pay.
I think you'd still have a tier of a lower tier where you did have the events that were kind of all year round, but for the top players, I just think possibly they should be playing less.
I
agree the idea that less tennis, why it sounds ridiculous, why am I saying that, but I do think we are going to have to think about protecting these players.
On a bit of a tangent about what I just said about all events should be combined events, just an asterisk to that is I really like the Canadian Masters, the Rogers Cup, the tandem Toronto-Montreal thing. I love that. I love this is Canada's week of tennis. We alternate which city hosts the men's, which hosts the women's. I know that wouldn't necessarily be possible in every country, every city, whatever, but
I
love that.
And you kind of get that during the summer grass court swing here. Okay, they're different events, but you've got Queens and Birmingham going on at the same time, and it's just a nice feel. Obviously, they don't alternate cities.
But I do like the idea of them being combined, though, actually being at the same place. It's just difficult to always find the right facilities that can accommodate that many players and that many. It's not always that easy. But I would love to see a lot more of that. The only other thing that's I find a shame is, for instance, when you're listening to this right now, this is in one of our couple of weeks where we're not just keeping up with the regular weekly tour. You have so many tournaments right now in places like Newport and Borstad and Gstaad and Kitzbühel and Umag. Fantastic tournaments, all of them. I've been to all of them at one time or another, pretty much anyway, and I love those tournaments. But on a sort of narrative level, they don't make a lot of sense. And because, you know, you're going straight from Wimbledon to Newport and it's a grass court tournament and it's after the Lord Mayor's show. And that's, I don't mean to be rude to Newport because it's clearly a really cool tournament. But I'd love it if it was in the run-up to Wimbledon as part of the grass court run-up. I've been to Gstaad many times. It's one of the most beautiful tournaments I've ever been to. And it does mean I haven't been to Borstad because it's the same week, or it has been traditionally in the past. And these are great clay court events. Love them. But why aren't they in the lead up to the French Open? Now, I know it's because there isn't room, but there should be room. There should be in an ideal world, you would have that leading up to the French Open. You would have Rotterdam, this fantastic event run by Richard Krajicek and his team, which is one of the oldest tournaments on the calendar, and it's so well run. And you want this indoor hardcourt tournament, in my eyes, leading up to the finals, if it's on an indoor hardcourt. And there's
it feels like a fudge, doesn't it? It's like, oh, these are great events, we want them, but we've got nowhere to put them, so blah, there you go.
It's events for the sake of events.
Yeah, it's a disservice to everyone because they are great events. Mm. Yeah.
And I think working within the current framework that we have in the calendar does always feel a bit weird that there's no grass court Masters or Premier mandatory event. I think that feels like a change that would benefit the tour, if just in terms of numbers, in terms of having more points available on the grass, is something that I think a lot of people would say makes sense. But how logistically do you do it? But in an ideal world, you would have a grass court Masters.
I mean, how have we got to a point where there is like 3 or 4 weeks worth of grass court tennis? Mm. Well, what is it? Maybe 5 weeks now, and yet there's so much of everything else.
And in the past, 3 of the 4 slams have been on grass.
Yeah. Catherine's gone now because a dog has just walked past. Yeah. So
that's my favourite one. And I make eye contact with that dog handler every evening, and my eyes are saying, I know that dog's working, but could you bring the dog back once it's finished its shift? And he locks eyes with me, and he knows what my eyes are saying. and he's never brought that lovely, lovely Labrador back to see.
He's just walking off now. Yeah. So there we are. Just a little aside. Anything else we would do with the calendar before we finish? Oh, hold on. The dog's coming back. Dog looks really happy. Delighted.
He's seen me.
Okay. So what else would you do with the calendar? Anything else? Would you move the Australian Open? Some people say it's a bit much. It starts in the year and it should have a proper run in, you know?
I think it kind of does have a proper... I mean, I'm nervous. We obviously haven't seen the new run in with the ATP Cup. So that'll be interesting next year.
Yeah.
I love that everybody's fresh for the Australian Open. There's absolutely no weariness at all. Everyone... I think Courtney was talking about it on one of our Wimbledon podcasts. You know, everybody rocks up there and they're so eager beaver and, you know, just got a twinkle in the eye and like, oh, tennis, I've missed tennis over the last, you know, 4.5 days when it wasn't happening. And I love that about the Australian
Open. They have more time, of course, with the off-season, at least. I mean, not Courtney, by the sounds of it. She just works all hours. Does a fantastic job. But the players obviously have a couple of months off.
And I think if you compare tennis to golf, which is obviously the other sport with four majors, I like the fact that the slams in tennis are spread more evenly throughout the year. It's as a golf fan, it's always felt a bit weird that they're so congested right in the middle of the season. You finish the last one and it's kind of 9 months before the next one, and I wouldn't want that in tennis. I do like that they are staggered throughout the year, and I like starting the year with a bang, with a slam.
Yeah,
gets you into it and the slate's clean, you don't know what narratives are going to come up, and then it really sets you up for the year.
And you have that local issue otherwise, don't you, of Australia being set up for the Grand Slam to take place during their summer holiday, which is January. It does work on that level. Plus, we all get to go to Australia, which is fantastic. So, I know that's irrelevant to you listeners if you don't get to go.
Is Solihull in January not a tourist destination?
I mean, there are similarities. I just can't think what they are. So, yeah. Okay, well, we're a bit unsure as to what to do with the calendar on a sort of mass scale, but there's a couple of suggestions. And I think we are all in agreement that the team event, just please, tennis, get it right.
What I would say about that is team events, I think we have been sceptical about having numerous team events because we're not sure if there's so many, what do they all mean, how are we supposed to be interested in them. But do we need to be careful about the fact that if players want team events and kind of if they're good for players' mental health and all that kind of thing, is it a bad thing if we have more team events?
That's a really valid point. My counter would be that I feel like there's a sort of zero-sum quantity of caring and interest in team events, and I would rather see that channeled into one rather than dispersed across many. I might be wrong.
I wouldn't mind.
And, you know, I think... one of the things that's annoyed me most about the response to changes and new events and all the rest of it is people just wanting to damn them before they've even happened. Just give these things a chance, okay?
Yeah.
Give it all a chance. Let's all cross our fingers and hope that it works and it's for the best of tennis. But that's my macro concern with how numerous they are now. I don't. And that is the macro concern with tennis as a whole, the competing agendas, the fact that the tours are separate, the fact that the ITF is separate, the Players Council versus the rest of the ATP, competing agendas. We should all be on the same page. And currently we're not. We should all be working for the best of tennis, and not everybody is at the moment.
I personally wouldn't mind there being additional events if there was enough variety of thought and to just come up with good solutions. But the absolute prerequisite for me is that there is one great one that everybody knows that it's like a slam. We need a fifth slam, and it needs to be a team event. I don't mind there being another couple. There could be a team event swing or something. I don't know. But maybe with a bit of variety in it, so that you have something different to make it feel different, or in a different place or something. I don't know, but we need that fifth slam, I think.
Yeah, and I think what people have been most critical of is the fact that currently we're going to sort of end the year with a team event and start the year with a team event. They're too close together, but also separated by the off-season. It just doesn't feel quite right.
If you try to explain that to anybody outside tennis who doesn't understand the factions and the reasons for it as such as they are, they would look at you as though you'd lost the plot. That us having a Davis Cup in late November, or whenever it is, mid-November, and then you... 6 weeks later you're doing another one, and you're still doing it nation against nation, and they're completely separate.
And Stefanos Tsitsipas might not qualify.
Well, apparently I read that he now is in, because they found a player. They found a player.
Who
that is
off
the street?
Yes.
Oh, no,
I've heard that there is a player now that he is able to partner with in order for them to enter the ATP Cup. That's what I've read. Let me see if I can possibly find that for you. On the
you don't how, know this player's hang on Matt
how far down
you don't
are you
know
going,
this player's name
I don't how far down are you going to have to scroll on the ATP
is
rankings?
It a ranked player, but you only need one ranking point, right, to be in with, because it's combined, it's like doubles, it's combined ranking. So there was talk of, I think, them trying to get Tsitsipas's brother a wild card into something just to get him a ranking
but it's
point,
much easier said than done to get a ranking point. There's a lot
crikey.
You have to be good.
What have you got, David?
Oh, I don't seem to have got much. No.
But isn't this in itself ludicrous? They've found Stefanos Tsitsipas, a human being with a pulse.
Here we go.
That they can give a ranking point to.
Mikhail Pervolakaris will have an ATP ranking on Monday, thanks to his career, his appearance at the tournament in Winnetka Challenger. He is Greek. This will allow Stefanos Tsitsipas to pretend to play the new ATP Cup, somebody said. I don't really know. But anyway, that's what I'm reading. So, two questions down, 34 minutes on the clock. We're not doing very well here, are we, folks? We might have to make this a two-parter.
Just one final thing. ATP Cup has ranking points, Olympics doesn't. Not on.
We'll underline that.
Well,
ludicrous.
Said.
Okay.
Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Okay, Alex's next question is, why are there not any or more openly gay active male tennis players?
He says there's been no openly gay man on tour in the Open era. In contrast, two of the all-time greats, Billie Jean King and Martina Navratilova, came out, and there are more on the WTA tour. Why has it not happened in the men's game?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a
fantastic question.
It's a huge sort of talking point generally. I mean, and I can't talk with 100% conviction about it, but having heard Brian Vahaly talk about it, and other people within the sport, it's nobody has, and it seems to me that there's a feeling that people aren't ready for it, or they're not confident enough to be able to feel comfortable in doing so. And as Kevin Anderson has said once or twice now, statistically, of course there are gay players on the men's tennis circuit who have not come out, because and why is that? Well, I can't definitively tell you, but I would imagine that they don't feel that they're going to be accepted or feel comfortable or be in that locker room and know that it's okay with everyone to not be treated differently in a way that they would be uncomfortable with.
And I think I would urge everyone to read Charlie Eccleshare's report, you know, special report on it, which I think was published at the start of this year. I think it was in January, where he had been asking a lot of the players about this exact question: why has no male player come out as gay? And there were some quite concerning quotes in that piece.
Absolutely.
from a lot of the players saying that, you know, saying things like they'd be happy, you know, they'd be fine with it as long as they showed respect, and things like that.
Kept it to themselves.
And things like, oh no, well, we're fine, we'll be fine with it. Sort of not self-examining and not thinking, not looking at themselves and thinking, would I be okay if someone came out as gay? How would that affect me? Sort of almost saying, yes, it would be fine, but because it doesn't affect them, it's quite an easy thing to say, and there's no actual action towards encouraging people to come out.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not working to achieve the solution, you're part of the problem.
Mm.
I think with this, and I think there's a lot of very prominent players that are guilty of that, guilty of complacency, guilty of saying, well, I would be fine with it, so I don't see the problem. And that's really
What should they be doing?
Examining the problem, I think, as Matt said, self-examination, I think, is a huge part of it. Not just instantly getting defensive and saying, oh, I'm not homophobic, I'd be fine with it. There is a problem here. There is evidently a problem, because of course there are gay men on tour. Of course there are. And whenever this topic comes up, and it's come up more recently because of articles like Charlie Eccleshare's, but it should be coming up all the time.
So
it's a great shame on men's tennis, but every time it comes up, I just think about the gay players that there are, because there are gay players, and I just think how awful that must be for them.
So
awful.
We know that Nick McCarville, a journalist colleague who has run a number of events now, to further the conversation and to get
really
people talking,
events,
and to get people, I imagine the point is to get people comfortable talking about it, so that there's a dialogue and there's a sort of conversation around this whole subject, so that it doesn't feel, in your words, other. And is that what you think it requires from tennis and from the players? I noticed at Nick's event a few players came, and that needs to happen, doesn't it? That in order for it to just become part of the norm and the sort of what happens day to day, without any suggestion that it isn't normal.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like there's a don't ask, don't tell policy at the moment, and how unbelievably out of date does that feel? I mean, yeah, of course it needs to be normalised, and it is, yeah, it's I mean, I can only relate it to the gender problem, because that sort of, if I, that enables me not to speak beyond my brief. But there is a, I talked about it in our we weren't allowed to call it the Gimmel Pod because that was too clickbaity, but the podcast that we recorded with Simon Briggs following the guilty plea of Justin Gimelshop, and the whole sort of
no contest plea,
the no contest plea of Justin Gimelshop, and the whole sort of airing of tennis's dirty laundry that followed that, there is an air of toxic masculinity about men's tennis at the moment, and I feel like the attitude towards women in equal pay and towards gay players is all part of that. Toxic masculinity is not, it has tentacles that reach into very distant corners. It's this celebration of laddishness that to me feels so completely dated, and it just strikes this horribly out of tune note. But if you're caught up in it and that's all you know, and it's exactly as Matt said, it's a self-examination, it's taking yourself out of what you know and going, hang on a second, is this right? Is this, I think that's what frustrates me / enrages me most about responses whenever, you know, gender-based issues come up. It's, I don't expect everybody to be 100% woke. I get it. I wasn't. It's the reflexive defensiveness. It's the total resistance to self-examination,
yeah,
that bothers me the most. And I think that is it's similar in the instance of homosexuality in tennis, and I just keep coming back to the thought of, there are gay players, there are gay male players, and it must be awful for them, and my heart breaks a little bit when I think about that.
They don't feel that they can come out.
Yeah, and that is horrendous in 2019.
And that's Alex's question, why has no one come out? It would have to be the environment that there is in men's tennis. I mean, coming out can be a difficult thing to do in front of family and friends, and you know who love you or whatever, let alone in front of a locker room where there is that laddishness and that toxic masculinity. I mean, it's if that is there, which we believe it is with everything that we've spoken about with Justin Gimelstob, if that's all there, it's not a surprise that someone hasn't come out, because why would they feel comfortable doing it in that environment? That's what has to change for it to happen.
Right, folks. Well, we expected to get through about 10 questions in this edition of the Tennis Podcast. We've got through 3. So I think, Alex, we're going to have to make this into a two-parter. And
it's a testament to how good Alex's questions were.
Very good questions, Alex.
Yes, we've immensely enjoyed that succession of conversation points. And we will do another version of this show next week here on the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by tennisballs.com, with our mascot Rio with a Y, owned by Alex, who asks such great questions. And so, yeah, join us again next week and we'll do this again.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.